Okay, thank you very much for inviting me. It's always a pleasure to be here at Fields, and it's a particular pleasure to be here at a conference dedicated to Kathleen. I think you've been an inspiration to several generations of women. I'm not sure if we've heard from my generation yesterday, so I should say that we remember who you are, we're looking at you, and we're taking example from you. Okay, so happy birthday, Kathleen. So my talk is going to be a little bit on a different subject from what you've been hearing so far. I don't work in nonlinear TV. I don't work in applied things, so you're going to hear something a little bit different. What I would like to talk about is some recent... and I have a typo there. It was supposed to be arithmetic progressions in sets of fractional dimension, and arithmetic is supposed to be spelled with an A and an E. So I'm sorry about that. Basically, what we're trying to do here is take some methods from an area which is now called additive combinatorics and try to use that in an analysis setting. Specifically, the results from additive combinatorics that we're looking at are all the work related to Samaradi's theorem, the proof due to Gowers, and other variations on that. There's a theorem of Gri and Tao on arithmetic progressions in primes, and again, there's a lot of follow-up work on that. And we would like to see if some of that can be used in an analytic setting. So here's a sort of a naive attempt to transfer a Samaradi-type theorem to analysis, specifically to perhaps geometric measure theory. Let me first state Samaradi's theorem. Suppose that A is a set of integers between 1 and some large n, and suppose that A has cardinality at least delta times n. Delta is intended to be a fixed positive number, and n is intended to go to infinity. Then, if n is large enough, we can find a k-term non-trivial arithmetic progression in A. This was conjectured in the 1930s by Erdős and Turán, and it was proved first for two-term progressions by Klaus Roth in 1953. Then it was proved by Samaradi for progressions of any length over a period of several years. He first did it for four-term progressions and then for general K. And that was not the end of the story, because there were several subsequent proofs. There was an ergodic theoretic proof due to Furstenberg, a harmonic analytic proof of Gowers. There were hypergraph-based proofs of Gowers and independently Nagelschacht, Rodl, and Skolkin. Each of those proofs led to a whole bunch of other things, various extensions, generalizations. You can go in all kinds of directions from there. Now, I said we were going to try to transfer that to an analysis setting, and here's a not very sophisticated attempt to do that. Suppose that we have a finite set of real numbers. Let's say that it's a k-term progression. Can we find a configuration that looks like A in any set of positive Lebesgue measure? Positive measure would be sort of like the analog of sets of positive density in the integers. And if in the integers we wanted to look for an arithmetic progression, in the real numbers we're going to be looking for an affine copy of, say, a given set. In this case, an affine copy of the first k integers is going to be a k-term progression, but you can look for other configurations as well. So is this going to be a good analog of Samaradi's theorem? Well, not really. similarities theorem is actually quite hard. It took a lot of time to prove it and a lot of effort, and we are still not even close to actually understanding the optimal quantities bound in it, for example. So there's a lot of work on it already, and there's a lot more work to follow. But this turns out to be pretty much trivial if you know your basic real analysis. So here's how you prove such a statement. You just use the Lebesgue density theorem, which says that almost every point of a set of positive measure is a density point. Well, what does it mean that you have a density point? It means that you can choose a small interval around that point such that the interval is almost entirely covered by the set in question. Okay? Now, if you choose that interval small enough, then you can find a copy of basically any finite configuration you want in that interval, just by trivial density arguments. Okay, so that was a little bit too easy, but now here's a hard question. And this one is due to Erdős. Can we do the same sort of thing for infinite sets? Suppose that we have a set of positive measure in the real numbers. Does it have to contain a fine copy of a fixed infinite set? For example, if we take the sequence 2 to the minus n for all n from 1 to infinity, does every set of positive measure have to contain an affine copy of that, translated and rescaled? Okay, so that's not known. There are examples of sequences for which it fails. The first such examples are due to Falconer a while ago, and there are also further examples due to Bourguin and Kolontzakis. Basically, the key point here is that the sequence has to decay slowly enough. It's natural to restrict attention to sequences that approach zero as n goes to infinity. And then if that sequence decays slowly, you can construct explicit Cantor-type examples where this sort of thing is going to fail. There are no examples of infinite sequences such that every set of positive measure would contain a copy of that. And in particular, the 2 to the minus n question is open. So that's something that we really would like to do. Now, but so far we're at the wishful thinking kind of stage in that regard. So instead we're going to be looking at easier questions. For example, one question that might be a little bit easier is, suppose that instead of looking for infinite patterns in sets of positive measure, we're going to look for finite patterns, but now instead of assuming that your background set has positive measure, we're only going to assume that the dimension of the set is somewhere close to one. So it's no longer a positive density case. You can no longer use the Lebesgue density theorem or anything of that sort. Here's the precise formulation of the question. Suppose that we have a finite set. Here I'm just going to look at a three-point configuration 0, 1, 2, so that an affine copy of that is going to be a three-term arithmetic progression. If a subset of the interval from 0 to 1 has Hausdorff dimension close enough to 1, does it have to contain an affine copy of A? Well, turns out that this question was actually solved before we thought of asking it. Tamás Keleti proved back in 1998 that there's a closed subset of the unit interval of dimension 1 but Lagrange zero, which contains no three-term arithmetic progression. In fact, he constructed that example in response to a different question, and so he proved something a little bit stronger, namely that any two translates of E intersect in at most one point. It can be translated into a statement about E having no additive quadruples, for those of you who know what that is. More recently, he constructed a somewhat more complicated example of a set, again a closed set of Hausdorff dimension 1, which avoids a whole sequence of three-point configurations. Okay, so far it doesn't look like we're getting very far with that. Now, if that was all, then basically I wouldn't be giving this talk here. So, we have to think about it a little bit differently, and specifically what we're going to do is we're going to look for inspiration in number theory, and specifically certain results in additive combinatorics. We want to know whether there are any summary type results that can be translated to the surface setting that I just talked about, a setting where you have sets of fractional dimension. Now, if sets of positive density corresponded sort of to sets of subsets of integers of positive density in the integers, then maybe fractional dimensional sets are somehow going to correspond to sets of zero density in the integers. And in fact, it turns out that this setting has been looked at in additive number theory and additive combinatorics. Specifically, we're going to look at the question of finding k-term arithmetic progressions in sets of density something like n to the 1 minus epsilon in the integers from 1 to n. There's a certain numerology here where that sort of thing would correspond to sets of dimension 1 minus epsilon in the reals. It's very heuristic, but it's there. Anyway, so the reason why I'm bringing this up is that, again, in general, this sort of statement would be false. There are examples of sets of density pretty close to one. There are examples of sets where the epsilon can be taken arbitrarily small, and the set contains no three-term arithmetic progression. This is due to Salem Spencer and then to Berend. But there are also positive results in that direction. Specifically, if we assume a little bit more about the set E, then, for example, if we assume that E can be embedded in a bigger set, which still has density zero in the integers, but is random in a way that can be made precise, then there is a summarity type theorem in that setting. The first such result is due to Hayakawa, Wuchak, and Radu from 1985. And then similar results are also due to Green and Tao, who proved that primes and also positive density subsets of primes contain k-term arithmetic progressions for any k. Again, the primes do not have positive density in the integers, so you cannot prove a summary type theorem there just based on density arguments. But what you end up doing instead is using a little bit more information about the primes. Namely, you need to know that they distributed randomly in certain ways that can be made rigorous.
You can replace n to the 1 minus epsilon. by n over log n.
Yeah, exactly. For the primes, it's n over log n, but by the prime number theorem. There are also results of that type for random sets where you have n to the 1 minus epsilon. It's basically done by the same methods. Okay, so let me first explain a little bit about random sets. This is a very well-known heuristic argument in additive number theory. Suppose that you have a subset of integers from 1 to n, which is random in the sense that every x belongs to A with some fixed probability delta between 0 and 1 independently. You can think of it as tossing a coin independently for each x, and then according to whether we get heads or tails, we either put x in A or else we don't put it in A. We should get a set of cardinality about delta times n. We also should get about delta cubed times n squared three-term arithmetic progressions in A. And that's based on the following argument. Suppose that we just want to count the number of all possible three-term progressions in the set of integers from 1 to n. Any such progression has the form x, x plus r, x plus 2r. There's about n possible values of x and about n possible values of r, so that's about n squared progressions. Now, each such progression might or might not be in A. Given any x, the probability that x is in A is delta. The probability that x plus r or x plus r squared is in A is also delta, and those three events are independent. So if x and r are given, there's a probability about delta cubed that all three elements are going to belong to A. So that's the number of three-term progressions. Now, notice that we didn't assume that delta is fixed and only n can vary. This argument is typically done in that setting. Delta is a fixed positive number, and then we let n go to infinity. But actually, this argument works just as well if you take delta to be something like n to the minus epsilon. It could go to zero as n goes to infinity. And that's the sort of a setting that we would like to have. Specifically, we'd like to come up with a concept of a random set or rather a concept of randomness which is going to capture that phenomenon even when your set is not actually random, that instead it's deterministic. Here we're not tossing coins, really, when we choose our sets, whether it's in the integers or in the reals. We have a deterministic set, and we want to know whether that particular set contains arithmetic progressions or whatever configurations you want to look for. So we want some concept of randomness which is going to be deterministic and which is going to be describe the same sort of behavior that we saw for random sets. Now, this is a key concept in all proofs of Semmeridis' theorem that we know so far. Each such proof looks at two cases. There's a random case and then there's a structured case. In the random case, you get a lot of arithmetic progressions right away. In the structured case, you have to do some more work before you can get a progression. And that concept of randomness depends on the length of the progression. It depends on the value of k. The same concept is essential in the existing results of Samaredi type in sparse sets, those that I mentioned earlier. Now, as I said, the exact concept of pseudorandomness that has to be used depends on the length of the progression. But in the case of three-term progressions, it's relatively simple, and the conditions can be, in fact, stated in terms of Fourier analysis. So that's what we're going to be doing here. What we want to do is prove a continuous analog of Roth's theorem, that's Samaredi's theorem for three-term progressions, in a setting where you have a set of fractional dimension in the interval from 0 to 1. We know from Caletti's work that there is no possibility of having such a theorem if you don't have some additional conditions on the set. So the question is what those conditions are going to be. And if we look at what has been used in number theory, then there's a good chance that those conditions are going to be Fourier analytic. Okay, so here's the result that we proved. This is joint work with Malabika-Pramanik. Suppose that we have a subset of the unit interval. We're going to assume that E is closed. We're also going to assume that E sports a probability measure which satisfies the following two conditions. The first one is that the measure of an interval of length epsilon is bounded by a constant times epsilon to some power alpha, where alpha is basically going to be the dimension of the set. And we're also going to assume a Fourier analytic condition on mu. We're going to assume that mu hat of k, the Fourier coefficients of mu, vanish like k to the minus beta over 2 for some beta greater than 2/3. If the alpha, the exponent in the first condition, is close enough to 1, depending on the constants, then we can prove that the set contains a three-term non-trivial arithmetic progression. Let me first explain what those conditions here mean. They're a little bit hard to look at first if you're not familiar with the subject, so I should give you a little bit of a background and explain why it makes sense to look at this type of conditions. First of all, the first condition is trivial. Not quite trivial. And I have a typo there. The sum should have been a supremum. We know from Fassmann's lemma in geometric measure theory that the Hausdorff dimension of E is the supremum, not the sum, of all alpha between 0 and 1, such that E sports a measure which satisfies the first condition. So it's just basically a dimensionality condition. It's not something that you should be really worried about. The condition that could be a problem is the second one, the one about the decay of the Fourier coefficients of the measure. There's a concept in geometric measure theory of something called Fourier dimension. This is defined as the supremum of all beta such that the second condition is satisfied. E sports a probability measure with mu hat of k bounded by a constant times k to the minus beta over 2 for all k. Now, we always know that the Fourier dimension is less than or equal to the dimension of the Hausdorff dimension of E. That can be proved using energy estimates. For example, In particular, it's not possible for the free analytic condition to be satisfied with any data greater than the dimension of E. On the other hand, it's quite common for the Hausdorff dimension to be strictly greater than the Fourier dimension. For example, if you take the two-thirds Cantor set, the standard Cantor set where you divide the interval in three equal parts, delete the middle third, and then iterate the procedure, then you can prove that this has Hausdorff dimension log 2 over log 3, but the Fourier dimension of the set is 0. There is, in fact, no measure supported on the set whose Fourier coefficients would have any decay at all. They do decay on average, that's again by energy estimates, but there is no pointwise decay of that sort. It's in fact quite non-trivial to construct examples where the equality holds, where the Fourier dimension is equal to Hausdorff dimension. This was first done by Salem in 1950. The examples he constructed are basically randomized Cantor type sets. You modify the Cantor construction, you divide the interval into some number of parts, then you delete some of them, and then you iterate that construction, and then you randomize various parameters in it. And you can prove that for a generic choice of parameters, the set that you get in the limit is in fact going to be a Salem set. This is in fact one of the reasons why we think that this is a good analog of the random examples in number theory that I mentioned earlier. There are other examples. For instance, Kahan constructed a large class of probabilistic examples. You basically take images of compact sets under two-dimensional or higher-dimensional Brownian motion. You take part of a Brownian path, and then you can prove that this sort of thing is almost surely a Salem set. These constructions of Salem and Kahane are probabilistic. They tell you that Salem sets exist, but they don't actually give you any specific example of a Salem set. The first such deterministic example was due to Kaufman. It's sort of a Diophantine Cantor type construction, and I'm not sure exactly how it's related to the Green-Tau type of results. In Green-Tau, in the results on progressions in primes, use that primes are randomly distributed. Kaufman, in his example, also uses primes in various places. I'm not sure whether it's the same sort of information that he needs about the primes. It doesn't look that way, but maybe it's somewhere in there. And then there are also other variations on those examples. There are some due to Bloom from about 10 years ago, and we also have a new class of examples in our paper. Now, the assumptions in our paper are similar to saying that the set is a Salem set, but they're not quite identical to that. There's a non-trivial question there, namely, are there actually any sets that satisfy our conditions? In some ways, our conditions are a little bit weaker than saying that E is a Salem set, because we don't require the Fourier dimension to be exactly equal to the Hausdorff dimension. On the other hand, we need a certain uniformity in the constants, and that's something that nobody had a reason to look at before, so that was not checked in the existing examples in the literature. So basically, we want to make sure that we are not proving results about sets that might not exist in the first place. Okay, so we went over the laundry list of examples. Turns out that Salem's examples obey our conditions with a small modification which is acceptable, and we can include that in the proof. Kahan's examples that don't obey our conditions as stated, but we can still prove that they contain three-term progressions, at least with positive probability, bounded away from zero. That there's a somewhat more direct argument that proves that. And we also have a new construction of Salem sets which obey the exact conditions that we use with any allowed choice of constants. Again, it's a randomized Cantor-type construction, so we don't get explicit examples. And one more thing that I should mention is that we now think that we can extend our proof to a somewhat more general setting. Specifically, instead of the pointwise decay of the Fourier coefficients, it's enough to assume that the Fourier series of the measure is in L 3 minus epsilon for some positive epsilon. On the other hand, we don't know any examples of sets where you would have a Fourier series in L 3 minus epsilon, and that would not be Salem sets. So we're not sure exactly how important that is going to be. And a couple of words about how we prove our theorem. Basically, we borrow the general strategy from number theory, specifically from the proof of Ross' theorem on three-term progressions in sparse sets of integers. The Kohayakawa-Wuchak-Rodl argument doesn't really carry over to our setting as far as we know. It's a little bit unfortunate, actually, because they can get a better argument. They can get a better exponent than Green-Tau, for example. But on the other hand, the Green-Tau argument actually does extend to our setting because it's based on Fourier analysis. Specifically, we use the version of it that's due to Ben Green. It's from a paper that preceded the Green-Tau paper on progressions in primes. And that was a paper in which Green proves that dense subsets of primes contain infinitely many three-term arithmetic progressions. So that's exactly the sort of thing that we want to imitate here. The idea is to regularize the measure. Basically, we rewrite the measure as a sum of two parts, mu1 and mu2. The mu1 is an absolutely continuous measure, which we obtain by convoluting mu with a cutoff function in the Fourier space. It's absolutely continuous, and moreover, we can prove that its density is bounded uniformly in alpha, where alpha is the dimension, if we assume the conditions that I stated earlier on mu. Mu 2 is a signed measure. It doesn't have to be non-negative. And it's random in the sense that the Fourier coefficients of mu 2 are small. And then what we do is basically we apply a version of Ross' theorem to the mu1 part that gives us a lower bound on an expression that sort of counts the number of three-term progressions in the set. And then we can also prove that the mu2 contribution is small, so it doesn't affect the part that we get from Rolle's theorem. It's basically the same sort of idea that Green and Tao use in their work. I just want to mention a couple of questions that are left and we think would be it would be interesting to look at it. So, for example, it would be interesting to look at configurations other than three-term progressions. If we look at three-point configurations other than an arithmetic progression, then basically the same method that we use works in that case. But this method does not extend to four-term or k-term progressions. In number theory, it's known that Fourier analysis is not quite enough to handle that case. So it's quite possible that we're going to need some sort of a higher order randomness condition. That sort of thing is being done in number theory. We don't know yet how to carry that over to an analytic setting. Another question is suggested by the recent work of Tim Gowers and Julia Wolf. Like I said, it's known that in general Fourier analysis does not control four-term progressions in number theory, but there are some situations in which that sort of thing does actually happen. There are some configurations, not arithmetic progressions, but other systems of equations, where you can actually prove things using Fourier analytic arguments. And so there's a question of whether that can be done in a continuous setting. And then, of course, there's a question about infinite sequences, which we don't know how to solve, and that's what we really would like to be able to get at some point. Okay, so maybe I should stop here. Thank you very much for your attention.